Okay, let's get started. Okay, let's get started. We're going to start with text before we get down to technicalities. Ignore the busy chart on the left-hand side. Let's get started with how to look at Torah. Okay, this is a piece from Danny Matt Zohar. We'll talk about the bibliography afterwards, but I want to jump right into things. Can I get someone who can read loud how to look at Torah?
If so, we would propose it to her right now with ordinary words, and better than all of them. To present matters of the world, even rules of the world possess words more sublime. If so, let us follow them and make a Torah out of them. Ah, but all the words of Torah are sublime words, sublime secrets.
Okay, then we're reading from Danny Matt, page 41. The Zohar is in the form of a Midrash. It's going to be Midrashic style. And that's important to note right from the start, because many of you don't have much background reading Yalkut Shmonis and Tanchumas. This is the style the Zohar is written in. 2. Woe to the human being who says Torah is ordinary words, Torah is sublime words. Okay, the origin of the word mysticism in English is from the word mystery, that there are mysteries behind reality. The mysticism does not come from the word experience. It is that there are mysteries behind the way we normally look at the world. Zohar falls into that also. The message of the Zohar is that there is a mysterious, sublime sod behind ordinary reality. Don't think of things in ordinary terms. And it's the rhetoric here is that if you want an ordinary book, if you want to read books terrestrially, the world, secular wisdom, the rulers of the world have much better books than the Torah. If you're reading no Torah for its plot, if you're, you know, God forbid, treating Bible as literature, then that's not the thing to do. You're looking to the Bible for its sublime level. No questions other than on the technical sense. Yet. Continue.
Come see. The world above and the world below are perfectly balanced. Israel below, the angels above. Of the angels is written, he makes his angels spirits. But when they descend, they put on the garments of this world. If they did not put on a garment befitting this world, and they could not endure this world, and the worlds could not endure them.
Good one.
If this is so with the angels, how much more so with Torah, who created them in all worlds, and for whose sake they all exist? In descending to this world, if she did not put on the garments of this world, the world could not endure.
So this
story of Torah is the garments of Torah. Whoever thinks that the garments is the real Torah and not something else, may his spirit deflate. He will have no portion in the world that is not.
Okay, so let's unpack this slowly. First of all, come and see. The Aramaic there, we're going to switch over. We're going to start an English reading of Zohar, then we're going to switch to the Aramaic. Come and see, tachazeh is the Aramaic there, substituting for the Gemara's tashma. So where the Gemara uses an auditory metaphor, Zohar is a visual metaphor. It is a visual tradition. Come and look at this with me. Things will be presented visually, not auditory, not discussion, but look at this. Let me give you an image. So knowledge is passed on through imagery. Next line, the world above and the world below are perfectly balanced. That is an important part of Zohar Kabbalah, the idea of the Aramaic there, Kigavna. Just like what goes on above goes on down below. There is a parallel universe. Whatever goes on above goes on below. Whatever goes on below goes on above. This is an important part of the Zohar's message, to see the mystery of the world. I'll take questions at the end of the section. To see the mystery of the world is understanding that there is this parallelism. So long as you don't accept premise one, you can't enter into this world. There's a parallel universe, a parallel understanding. Whatever goes on above goes on below, and vice versa. Next, the angels. When angels come down to this world, they put on garments of this world. Okay, the angels we think of here are not the modern angels that you see on Hallmark cards, what's called the Swedenborg angel. These are the Judeo-Islamic angels that take on bodies when they come on. They're immaterial up above, and they take on bodies when they come to this world. If anyone ever see the German movie Wings of Desire, has a Peter Falk playing one of these sort of angels that has to take on a body. This is the image. It's an image of matter. When it the more it comes down, the more enclosement it gets. The obvious metaphor in return is the more you go up, the more you divest yourself of materiality. So the same way angels have to put on a garment, but you realize that they're a spirit, so too Torah. I mean, if it's true with angels, how much more so for Torah? So Torah puts on a garment to come down into this world. Someone who only does Bible as literature, who only looks at the narrative, who only looks at the story, is missing the real Torah. The real Torah is the coordinate in this alternate world. And then in this, you know, wonderful narrative, you know, may their spirit deflate and they have no world share in the world to come, if you only have a surface literary historic read and you don't read it in terms of this other perspective. Yes?
What do you say in relation to Kigavna? Kigavna
means the world above and the world below are perfectly balanced. I mean, the Zohar is going to always say Kigavna, just like we do below. Kigavna means just like. Just like we do below, it affects what's above. Whatever's up above affects below. Yes?
In the third paragraph, the second line, it says, so with the Torah, who created all the world?
Mm-hmm.
The Torah, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's very midrashic. The word Torah is what created the world. Now, if you think that you can create the world by chanting a biblical narrative in some sense, then you don't really get it. When you say the Torah created the world, it's this primordial Torah that's much, much beyond anything we have in our books. Okay. I mentioned already this is a visual tradition, but a second point that you should have already picked up on, Zohar is a Torah study tradition. It's about seeing the mystery through Torah study. And that way it's very rabbinic. It's an outgrowth of Chazal. It's continued. It's a variant of certain passages of Chazal. It's a mysticism of Torah study. By learning to see this other level. Okay, turn the page. It is what Torah is. That's correct.
There's no, but it's, I mean, it's still written by, still in its own garment. Still.
Well, we're going to talk about the relationship on the next page. Continue.
That's why David said, open my eyes so I can see wonders out of your Torah. What is under the garments of Torah?
Okay. The phrase here is open your eyes, using that verse from Psalm 119, that's an important metaphor here, that you want your eyes to be opened. I mean, the Ramban uses it also, the same verse in Torah Hashem Tamima, to see the wondrous nature of Torah. Continue. Come and see.
Come and see. There's a garment visible to all. When those fools see someone in a visible garment, they look no further. But the essence of the garment is the body. The essence of the body is the soul. So it is with Torah. She has a body. The commandments of Torah call the embodiment of Torah. This body is clothed in garments, the stories of this world. Fools of the world look only at that garment, the story of Torah. They know nothing more. They do not look at what is under that garment. Those who know more do not look at the garment, but rather at the body under that garment. The wise ones, servants of the King on high, those who stood at Mount Sinai, look only at the soul, root of all, real Torah. In the time to come, they are destined to look at the soul of the soul of Torah.
Okay, let me unpack this. Once again, come and see. Different metaphor, different image. The image here is going to be back to the idea of the garment of Torah. Underneath the garment is a body. Underneath the body is a soul. And deeper than that is the soul of souls. So this next imagery is the body is feminine. So I've given you visual, Torah. There is now going to be eros and a relationship of male and female as one of the major messages of the Zohar. The way it's being played out here is that use the imagery of a garment. Only a fool judges a person solely by the garment. Instead, you have to know there's a body. The body is the mitzvot of the Torah. But deeper than the body is going to be the soul. So the same way you judge a person, not just by the garment and the body, but by the soul, you judge the Torah not just by its garment and not just by its mitzvot, but by the soul, which is the Kabbalistic element. So only fools get caught up and look at the garment. But you have to look at the body, you have to look at the soul. And deeper than that is the soul of souls, which is only known at Har Sinai, Mount Sinai, and in the time to come, Atid Lavo. So we have the garment of Torah, which is the narrative, the body of Torah, which is the mitzvot, the soul of Torah, which is now the mysterious, sublime reading, and now the soul of souls, which is even a deeper understanding of Torah, which only showed itself at Har Sinai, and will show itself Atid Lavo once again, which is the soul of souls. Okay, you also, wait, we just finished one more point. You also have that conjunction, or that phrase in Kabbalah, in Zohar, that you always know where to refer to that level. Whenever you have the soul of souls, the holy of the holy, the deep of the deep, you know you're always referring to that level. The something of a something. What? A nishmata de nishmata. That's the fourth level. It's always inaccessible. That is, it was only showed at Har Sinai and will show itself again in Atid Lavo. And I don't want to deal with what the definition of Atid Lavo is yet.
Four.
Garment, body, soul, and soul of souls. Normally you deal with a narrative, you deal with mitzvot, you deal with the level of sod, and beyond that is now this revelatory knowledge from Har Sinai. Yes?
Mystical experience
is the reading of the Torah on the level of soul, the root of all the real Torah. That's right.
Only the
Atid Lavo
can you get to that?
No, I didn't say Atid Lavo. That's right. But Atid Lavo is going to be accessible here in various ways.
Shabbat.
What? Well, they're going to talk about where and how in the interpretive, where it's available. Yes. We're going to get there. Trust me, it's going to come up. I just don't want... you have to have some basis before we get there. Yes?
This is garment.
What? A narrative.
Garment is a
narrative. Right.
So.
Yes. I'm not sure what the question is.
Like,
It seems sort of logical. What's the question?
Yeah, no, I'm saying is which one's which? Like, is the theme of, like, to God and what dictates the...
A vision?
Visual metaphor.
Okay, so there are texts that are non-metaphorical that are visionary. That's why I'm going to say this is Zohar. There'll be many texts out there, and that's going to be one of the differences, whether Moshe de Leon on Masa Merkava is not metaphorical. It is visionary without being metaphor. Brit Menuchim, a lot of this material will not be metaphor. Part of the attraction of the Zohar is that it is written in this style. Which is okay. Let's go on.
Come and see, so it is above. There is garment of body and soul and soul of soul. The heavens that are close to the garment, the communion of Israel's body, who sees the soul, the beauty of Israel. So she is the body of the soul. The soul who I mentioned is the beauty of Israel, who reveals her. The soul of the soul is a holy ancient one. All is connected, this one to that one.
Okay. There are four levels here, and that's important to note. Kabbalah is about the number four, as much as whatever the attraction of that 10 Sfirot chart, which is a 10. Kabbalah is about four. The Shem Chavaya, the Tetragrammaton, is four letters. They're seen as four levels to reality. And I'm not going to explain these yet. I'm going to come back and explain these later. The four levels, we have the lowest level, the garment, is the heaven and the hosts, the world we live in. There is something higher than that communion of Israel, Knesset Yisrael. Like I said, hold off on what that means. There is something higher than that Tiferet Yisrael, the beauty of Israel. And that's real Torah. And there's something ever beyond that called Holy Ancient One, Atika Kadisha. So we have Knesset Yisrael, Tiferet Yisrael, and Atika Kadisha as being three levels beyond our world. Continue.
Woe to the wicked who say that the Torah is really a story. They look at this garment and no further. Happy are the righteous who look at Torah properly. As wine must sit in the jar, so Torah must sit in this garment. So look only on what is under the garment. So all those words and all those stories, they are garments.
Okay. So everything is connected, this one to that one. This is all seen as one big unity. And something we're going to come back to, they saw this not as separate things, but as a unity. They saw life, the world, as one big unified level in which their all levels are connected. There's a chain of being, a ladder of ascension, a metaphor in which there is all these levels that bring you up to the levels into divinity, which we don't actually have as much in the modern world. If you're not into quote-unquote spirituality or you're not a follower of Cook, you don't use these unified metaphors about how all reality works together. In fact, we kind of think about, how our atmosphere and God, we don't even think of them in the same cosmology. They put it all in the same cosmology. Above our atmosphere starts the levels of divinity. And then woe to the wicked who only look at the surface level. Okay. This is, yes?
This
is standard medieval cosmology. Standard 13th century cosmology. Yeah. The Mishnah Torah. Yisodei HaTorah. It's all the chapters people skip. Yisodei HaTorah. Prakim, Bet Gimel, and Dalet. I mean, I don't know. Very few places that you won't find it. Rashi on most of these Tehillim. Your teachers always skipped over the seven heavens. Unless you had me. You had... your teachers would have guaranteed to skip over the cosmological Rashis. Now you can turn back to page one. What were those four levels? Okay, back to page one of this thing. You have this nice graphic chart. Okay, Kabbalah is this chart, and this chart is a chart of God.
For
13th century Kabbalah. This is God. These are the interdivine structures. Meaning whether you're going to say this is God, God himself, his essence, or you're going to say this is the way God manifests himself. But this is a chart of the interdivine structures of the divine. So let me go through this chart, limiting to the question of explaining the chart, and then I'm going to go back and explain those four levels. And then we'll talk afterwards where this chart came from. Starting on the very top, the Ein Sof, the infinite. That's not in the Zohar itself, but that's the infinite unknown aspects of the divine. It will be in other Kabbalists of the 13th century. Below that you have the divine mind, Keter, Chachma, and Bina, and then the divine body, Chesed, Gvura, Tiferet, Netzach, Hod, Yesod, Shechina. This will, the top three, Keter, Chachma, Bina, will correspond to elements in the divine mind. Chesed and Gvura will be right and left arm, Tiferet will be torso, Netzach and Hod will be right and left leg, Yesod will be male genitals, and Shechina will be female genitals. This will be also stand for colors, the top three all being light colors, meaning the color of light, sunshine. And then Chesed is white, Gevurah is red, Tiferet's a whole range of greens, purples, blues, Netzach and Hod will be in pink range, Yesod will be yellow-orange, and Shechina will be either bluish-black or white, depending on which light metaphor you use. This will also stand for the patriarchs. Chesed is Abraham, Gevurah is Yitzchak, Tiferet's Yaakov, Netzach's Moshe, Hod is Aaron, Yesod is Yosef, and Shechina is David. This works in terms of specifics also of Shechina with Tiferet. So for example, Tiferet is the sun, Shechina is the moon. Tiferet's heaven, Shechina's earth. Tiferet's the king, Shechina's the queen. Tiferet is the bridegroom, Shechina is the bride. Now, where does this come from? Okay, where does this come from? And this is, yes?
Is Tiferet only a mixture of Gvura and Chesed, or is it also Chesed and Chachma?
It is going to be a mixture of almost everything, and that's going to be a lot of what we're going to be talking about in this course. You're going to be spending a lot of time, and you're going to know great detail about this by the end of the course.
So Tiferet's...
We're going to go through all the qualities of these by the end of the course. Okay, this is an overview because Kabbalah needs to get you started. It's not something I can start off talking just about Keter and say I'm going to talk about the system afterwards. So this is the overview, and then we're going to unpack it slowly. Now, where does this come from? I'm going to do the same thing here. I'm going to give you the history on one foot, and then we're going to come back to it later in the class. Where does this come from? Kabbalists read Tanakh, they read Mikra, not as metaphor, but as actual descriptive reference. So when it says Hashem Ish Milchama in Shmot, in Shirat Hayam, and later it calls God a Kavod, when they go into the Midbar, and then God is Hashem in Devarim, and God is Atik Yomim in Daniel, and God has a right and left arm in Tehillim, For a Kabbalist and anyone who follows this tradition from Bayit Sheni on, these were all separate references within God. So where moderns tend to take these things as metaphors, and they're all pointing to the same object, this way of thinking from Bayit Sheni on thought about, or you can say within Tanakh itself, thought about these as separate entities. So if Yeshaya talks about the God as mother, God as bride, while Daniel is Ancient of Days, there had to be two different aspects to God. That was a given in this reading. When you get to Chazal, in a Kabbalist read, when the Gemara talks about the Shekhinah, talks about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, talks about Gvura, talks about how blessings have to move God from Midat HaDin to Midat HaRachamim, they are all different places. They're all different elements of God. I'm not up to Tzvirot yet. I'm aware of it is that there's different elements of God. A Kabbalistic read is that when the Gemara talks Shekhinah and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, they've got to be two different reference. Okay? Technical sense, they are denotative, not connotative, for anyone who needs that sort of language. Okay? They are denotative to separate points. Yes? No, that's the way they read it. I mean, this is not an after the fact reading, because let's continue. Late Midrash, this is quite explicit. The Midrashim that are not part of your standard curriculum, you know, the Tana de Bei Eliyahu's, all of the Provençal Midrashim, the Midbar Rabbah, the Yalkut Shmonis, all that has this within it already. The Pirkei de Rav Eliezer, the Psik de Rav Tekahana, it is there already. So this is now growing out of it. But let's now move to the Middle Ages. In Ashkenaz will develop a kavod theory that God makes himself manifest. And the most famous example of that is the Anim Zmirot, which is a hymn to the male body of God. You know, God has beautiful black curls. You know, this wonderful description of God's body. If we look at the Mediterranean, you think of Ibn Gabirol's poem Keter Malchut, which opens up with a line from Divrei Hayamim, Lecha Hashem, Hagdula Vagvura, Feret Netzach Vahod, and then explains the chain of being from the oneness of the divine into the ordinary world. Sadia Gaon will have a kavod nivra, that God has a created glory that he shows to the world, and it could take on different forms. So by the time we get to the 13th century, the 13th century is a time when Ashkenaz and Mediterranean come together in Provence and Aragon. Into that mixture, they have both Ashkenaz and philosophic texts. And they have lots and lots of now new books from all over the Gola. And you have Moshe Hadarshan, who had just edited a lot of these Midrashim in Provence. The systemization of all this God language into a unified system in the 13th century is called Kabbalah. Beforehand, we don't call it Kabbalah, we call it Theosophy, we call it Jewish mysticism, whatever you want to call it, but Kabbalah becomes that technical point in the 13th century when this chart gets created. Before this point, text, you know, you had lots of different versions. You'll have texts that will talk about God as a 7, God as a 13, God is a four, God is a five. From the 13th century on, everything gets systematized into this chart, and nobody goes back anymore to look at most of the ancient cosmologies. The books of the 13th century really superseded. I mean, now scholars and others want to go back to these earlier books, but they weren't continuing. They don't play the same role. The 13th century books superseded them because they created a tight system in which everything now fit in. The original name for this was called Sod, and certainly in the 1230s, this field was called Sod. But as we come to the end of the 13th century, it'll shift its name to Kabbalah, and we'll explain more about that later. So this chart is where everything comes in, and even if it didn't fit in, they go out of their way to make sure everything fits it in. Yes. Thank you. That's what we're going to get to. There were over 30 Perushim on the Sefer Yetzirah in the 13th century because that's one of their issues. Meaning, we don't speak the world, as much as you guys don't speak medieval, you don't speak late antiquity either. Their goal is now to translate the language of late antiquity into the language of the Middle Ages. And therefore, you need commentary to bridge that cultural gap. So a book like Sefer Yetzirah, which is all late antiquity, I mean, even if you think about the Rav Simloy, why do we have 613 mitzvot corresponding to the limbs of the body and to the cosmos, the zodiac and the sky? That's late antiquity thinking about the parallels between the human body and cosmology and the zodiac. Medievals didn't make that macrocosm-microcosm connection, and therefore you explain it now with this new way of thinking of the systematized charts.
So basically, we read the history with the new system.
They are culturally remediating it, and that's why it becomes a debate. I'm not saying it's rereading, because that would imply that it's not correct.
Right.
Is that people are not speaking Greco-Roman cosmology as much as most of you are not speaking medieval terms, as much as I'm going to push you into medieval terms anymore.
And this is also the case with the Mahir and Sefer Yetzirah and things like that.
That's correct. The reason we don't read Ashkenaz texts anymore is because they are written in an antiquity, late antiquity way, and we 13th century on becomes the point that we start. Just to jump ahead to the other side, in the 16th century, when the Middle Ages, when there was no longer the medieval cosmology, you now live in a post-Copernicus world, or a world in which science, the world of science and religion has changed once again, Kabbalah becomes a freestanding field. It no longer becomes grafted onto your scientific cosmology, and therefore figures like the Ramak and the Ari take it out of the medieval, and we create now this early modern context for reading it. Okay?
Yeah.
So now we can go back to the original passage. First of all, if you think of the Zohar itself, notice its main point was not to teach you Svirot, was to teach you about the mystery of the Torah. Where Svirot are now going to come in is on that, go back to page 44, that last paragraph. Come and see when I have, now let's plug it into the chart. The heavens and the host are the garment. This world is the lowest level. Communion of Israel, Knesset Yisrael, is the Shechina. It's Tiferet Yisrael is the sphere of Tiferet. Atzik Yomin is Keter. Notice that the passage of the Zohar stands regardless of this. This passage doesn't make or break the whole piece of the Zohar. It's now plugging in to a system that you already know. So the difference is the image of the woman in a garment and her body and her soul, or the image of the angels being enclosed, those are creative symbols. Those are primary symbols. This, on the other hand, is now use of something external that could have just as well been plugged in. You could just as well plug in Sefer Yetzirah or Hasidic Ashkenaz or anything into this passage, because that's already a translation paragraph. I've given you this mystical view of reality. Let me now translate it into another text. Okay? Now, in some form, this was the entire course already. But that's not where we're going. Now we can get down to the syllabus. Since we started late, I'm putting the syllabus, giving the syllabus now, because I want to see how much time we're going to have left. Okay. Do you have any question over there? Do you want to ask a question? Okay. Is everyone? Okay. Okay, we're going to do the basic concepts of the Kabbalah. We're going to center on reading Zohar in class. I'm going to start in English, and then we are going to move to the Aramaic text so you can make a laning. But in the beginning, I've got to get my points across, and I do not want to spend my time correcting your Aramaic for the first classes. But there will be plenty of time for that after I give you charts and all the tools that you need. We're also going to be reading Yosef Chikatilis Sharei Ora, so you learn that Sirotic chart. I mean, I gave you a brief overview of the Sefirot, but that's going to be, we're going to divide it up, really one class a week is really going to be Zohar and history. The other one is going to be reading Sharei Ora and talking about Sefirot. Which day is which, we'll see. I will give you photocopies of Zohar in class. Okay, you will need a Isaiah Tishbe's Wisdom of the Zohar. It is available. It retails for $100. It now is down to 80 certain places. If you know how to work the web, you can get it for about $35, $40 new. If you know how to do a good search on the web, yes. No, Wisdom of the Zohar is a topical, three-volume topical arrangement. A several thousand page topical arrangement with introductions. It's something you will definitely use because here you now want to speak about Sukkot, or you want to speak about Karbanot. There's a chapter on sacrifice, and here are the texts that translate it for you. As the course goes on, you'll learn more about the different translations. We will also be using Danny Metz, what we started with, the Book of Enlightenment, the Classics of Western Spirituality version, because there's enough text in here for our English first part of the course to understand what's going on. Text from his new translation, the Stanford University translation, I will give out to you, but there weren't enough specific text in Bereshit that justified by having you buy the text. The other thing, or the major thing you must buy, is the Sharei Ora. Okay, I use the Wasser 1883 edition, which has recently been reset into square print with various little notes and it's readily available. Every bookstore, Beagle Eyes and Eichler's, will all have copies of it. It's readily available. In general, when you buy Kabbalistic books, they are priceless in the sense that since they don't sell huge numbers of them, they can you'll be charged whatever they feel like on a given day. Not that they are expensive, but there is not a market price. I mean, they could be $7 one day and $10 the next day because they're not moving many pieces of them. So just know that in general for buying Kabbalistic books. What'd you say? Yeah. So Shari Ora, you're going to need starting next week, or I'll photocopy for the first time, but certainly for 2 weeks from now, please have a Shari Ora. Shari Ora has been translated into English as Gates of Light by Avi Weinstein. The book has been remaindered and cut out, and you can get it for about $7 because it didn't go over well. It's a translation that for most readers did not make life easier. So Kinuyim of Shem Hashem became cognomens of the Tetragrammaton, and most people preferred Kinuyei Hashem to cognomens of the Tetragrammaton. The whole book reads like that. It's a great translation, but it didn't have a market value. So if you want it in English, that's fine too. Okay, you do not have to buy a Zohar for the class, but if you are going to buy one at the Svarim sale, buy the Masada Rav Kook 3-volume edition and the 2 volumes of Tikkuni Zohar, 1 volume Tikkuni Zohar, 1 volume Tikkuni Chadash. There is a new tradition for the last few years by a translation of the whole Zohar, I mean, with modern Hebrew translation. Like a Steinsaltz or a Kahati translation of the Zohar by Yehuda Edry. A lot of people really like it. The Sulam does that also, but then you are buying a much bigger set, and it also comes with a Lurianic Perish also. That's fine. Okay, you can always reach me by email. In terms of, there will be a midterm and a final. Do not expect it to be overly difficult. The first take home, there'll be also 2 Targilim. The first one will be, here's a passage of the Zohar. Here are the basic translation things. Let me see that you can get through a passage just so I can get to the second half of the course. Meaning it's not that one you can't be late with because it's a diagnostic to see whether you've gotten to this point in the course so I can go on to the second part. And then the last second one is you to actually prepare a little piece on your own. Okay, the final is harder than the midterm. The midterm is once again, you know, can you identify the basic things that I've said? The final is already now much more cumulative of material. Okay, so you look at the topics, the readings. For the first week, meaning this week and next class, reading Major Trends, chapters 5 and 6. And then you can see we're going to be reading Shari Ora Tishbe. You can see how it sets itself out. The next page is all Shari Ora Tishbe. Mid-course we switch, or not mid-course, it's a little bit past mid-course, we switch to a historic overview. I start again with Bayit Sheni, and I walk you back up to the 16th century, but not in 5 minutes, but over several weeks. Week 13. Turn to week 13. Week 13, which really falls in December, at the end of December, know already that that's going to be luminous on your agenda for what you're doing over Thanksgiving, because that's reading huge amounts of Shalom and Idel for the final. By that point, you've read enough basic texts of basic texts of Zohar and Shari Ora that you can then go back and look to Idel and Shalom, which is the sort of final question, and that's sort of, it's always on the final, to compare the two based on what we did in class. That's not a hint. That's basically telling you bear that in mind. What? Geshen Shalom and Moshe Idel on the final. What?
No surprise.
Okay. What? It's the same. Okay. Let me give out some other stuff since we are not for this class. Let me deal with some other things that we have to get out right now. Yes, we will. Let me just get out some other stuff before we go on. So let's deal with the side issues that come up right from the start. First of all, can one study Kabbalah before the age of 40? Okay. Now the source of that of the idea is the Mishnah says Arba'im Labina. You reach the stage of being at the age of 40. There's a medieval Ashkenaz tradition to not teach the 40, the Shem Membet, the 42-letter name, until you reach the age of 40, so you shouldn't use it improperly for magical purposes. But that's the only place that applied. Rav Moshe Cordovero in his Or Ner Rav says that everyone should start studying Kabbalah at the age of 20, assuming that you've had the appropriate rabbinic training to the age of 20, meaning you're in the middle of your rabbinical studies, in the middle of your Gemara studies, you're about 20 when you get...
What? What is he considered rabbinic studies, though? Is he studying two dot Gemara,
No, I think he assumes that you have a certain solid basis by 20. He does not quantify it.
What is the
remark?
Say that again.
Or Nerov. And use the Hebrew. And that was the general way the rabbinic elite started studying Kabbalah at the age of 20. In fact, most Kabbalists died before the age of 40. 40 remained the age that you usually needed for the magical or the prophetic aspects of Kabbalah. They did not want 20-year-olds seeking prophecy. They saved that for the over 40-year-olds to seek prophecy. Yes?
That was a stage that
one could start working on it.
So that was only taught.
That's right.
So the prophecy and magic.
But the standard stuff, the intro to Zohar, was something you started at 20. But in 1760, in Eastern Europe, the Frankists were a group of Sabbateans who said that the blood libel was true, and they went to the Catholic Church saying that the blood libel was true, and we knew that. Now the Frankists said that they also then converted to Catholicism. They said it's a new messianic age. We are now living the Torah of the Neshama, in which the original body doesn't need to be looked at anymore.
By converting, they're doing that?
Yeah. So therefore, anything that was formerly Usser is now Mutter.
No, it's Chaya.
What? Chaya, okay, Chaya. Okay. So it's now a Chiyav. All Karet is now a Chiyav. It's now necessary. There was a real Matir Isurim. I don't want to go into the details here. But among the Matir Isurim is now saying that the blood libel is true and telling, being Moser to the Catholic Church. And they said that this is based on the study of Kabbalah because they reached this level of the Neshama, the Nishmata. Now, at that point, the Vad Arba Artsot, the Council of the Four Lands in Poland, made a decree that anyone under the age of 40 should not study Kabbalah. What? The Council of the Four Lands, the Vad Arba Artsot in Poland. But basically it only applied to the uneducated Jews. The rabbinic elite into the 18th and 19th centuries continued to start studying Kabbalah at the age of 20. You know, we know that from their curriculums and their own autobiographies. That's when they started studying. But since the American Jewry is descendant pretty much from the uneducated masses of Eastern European Jewry. That idea that it's usher to study Kabbalah before 40 came over with it. You do not generally find it among communities from the Edot HaMizrach saying you don't study Kabbalah till the age of 40. They don't go around saying it the way Ashkenazi Jews. And most of the edicts of the Vat Arba Artsa were real diatribes against the masses who couldn't read Chumash and Rashi and didn't know basic halacha but wanted to study Kabbalah. Yes? What? The Frank, Jacob Frank used to go around, one of his great sayings is, I'm a prostak, I am an unlettered Jew, and he was very proud of it.
And he was under 40?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, he was very proud to be a prostak. Next question, let's take care of this. We're going to come back to it when we do the history, so I'm not doing it in great detail. Who wrote the Zohar? Yeah, you have any? Are you answering?
What?
Okay, so.
Was it me? I know.
Okay. Okay, so let me get started with this. If you read the Zohar, and you actually are someone who reads it rather than polemicizes pro and against it, the book reads like a post-Talmudic book. So you'll find Rav Avram Galanti in Svat, or the Kamarna Rebbe in Galicia saying right out that it's post-Gemara, because it has very obvious things like, what? Avram Galanti and the Kamarna Rebbe. Among others, I mean, just give you 1/16th and 1/19th, because it has statements like Amru Razal, and then a direct quote from Bava Basra, which is the way Tanhuma reads. It's not the way, if you really know the literature, that's not the way ancient books read, to go Amru Chazal and then quote the Gemara. It definitely reads like late Midrash, and most of the people who get in these polemics don't realize that if I asked you, for example, when was Tanhuma written? Let's take that as an example. What? 9th? Probably about 11th. I mean, there's a real element there of Midrash Yelamdenu, of Rav Tanchum, from the age of the Gemara. There is then a late Midrashic version at the end of the Gemara. And then there's some a Byzantium recension in the 11th century that is light mysticism and all sorts of things post-Islamic conquest that will come up. The same way Pirkei de Rav Eliezer is the same way, or Masechet Sofrim. A lot of these books mention Islamic conquest and are late books, and there's nothing to do about it. Pirkei de Rav Eliezer, that doesn't mean that it doesn't have antiquity, but it is a late work. And that's what we're going to talk about. Zohar is writing in a consciously an ancient archaic style, meaning it is preserving it, and we're going to talk about why and afterwards, because we already have a book that's, meaning those who are editing books, for example, have anyone ever looked at Midrash HaGadol? The Temani Midrash. The Midrash HaGadol quotes the Rambam.
Wow.
Now, it's not passing off the Rambam, because it'll quote Amar Rav Meir, Amar Rav Tanchum, Amar HaRambam Zal. It's not passing anything off. Is that it's a consciously archaic style to write in that way still in the 13th century. Well, let me finish. That brings us up. It's clearly post-Chazal. But you will also find in the Zohar elements that seem to be quotes from Kuzari, Rambam, Ramban. Placing it somewhere in Reconquest Spain. Beyond that, let me just finish this. There's also the halacha of the Zohar is an Ashkenaz minhag, with a Svarad Sidur, which means you've got to be late 13th century influx of Ashkenaz practice, like reading Rabbeinu Yonah or the Ramban, in a Svardi, in a Spanish synagogue. I mean, the text in front of us is Spanish synagogue, Spanish liturgy, Ashkenaz customs. Most of the halacha of the Zohar goes back to earlier Ashkenaz sources. So the fact that you have both together already dates it to someplace in the late Reconquest, late 13th century. You also have Spanishisms, like the synagogue Beit Knesset is called in Esnoga. So we've got to be someplace in, Al-Andalus to say something like that. Beyond that, we also have four levels of interpretation, Pshat, Remez, Drusot at some point. And that idea is the school of the Ramban and Rabbeinu Bechaya on the Torah. The idea of Pardes, of different levels of interpretation, was something that all late 13th century Reconquest Spain Rishonim thought, because they had to bring together, if you were educated in which you knew Spanish philosophy, Midrash, Halacha, Ashkenaz esotericism, you put it together as Pshat, Remez, Drush, and Sod, different versions of it, Hapardes, Nisan. There's going to be different of these schemes in which you can layer out your knowledge, and that also places the book. What? Chida. It doesn't really work, but it doesn't really, what? Allegory. It means allegory. Philosophic allegory. I mean, there are many of these schemes. We'll come back to them. But the fact to arrange other communities, we don't go today, we don't give shir today and say, what's the pardes? That one of the qualities of, you know, the end of the 13th century was to say there is different levels and to present knowledge that way. So that further dates the recension of what's in front of us. Okay, let's go back to a little bit beyond that. This shouldn't have been controversial, but in the early modern period, from the 16th all the way to the 19th century, the question of canon became quite polemical. So on some point in the 16th century, it's really going to be the Ezer Ladat is going to be polemicizing against Kabbalah, and the Yechiel of Pisa is going to be polemicizing against philosophy. It becomes a debate, what is the canon? Which is then going to continue through the early modern period, in which you now have a debate over what's the canon, culminating in the work by Rav Yaakov Emden, who does show that the Zohar is a medieval written work, giving all most of the things that I said, showing that it's a medieval work. But then when we come to the 19th century, it becomes rather acrimonious, in which people start arguing about the Zohar without ever referring to the text anymore. You have people arguing about the sanctity of the Zohar versus modernity, because people stopped learning Kabbalah. Meaning, in even places that were heavily Kabbalistic, like Italy, there's a clear break at the end of the 18th century where they stopped doing Kabbalah. So anyone who was doing it in the 19th century becomes very defensive and starts arguing this is the Rashbi and don't say anything else. under very, very polemical terms. And that becomes a study of 18th, 19th century about how did the term shift within the debate. But in the somewhat simplicity of Tzvat, they had no problem saying this is a Gaonic work, because they read Midrash and Kabbalistic works all the time, And they knew this was not a work from antiquity. It was clearly a later work. And it's really Yaakov Emden shows that really collected that it is a late work. Now we bring in the issue of Moshe de Leon, who we'll come back to. Yaakov Emden shows that it's Moshe de Leon and leaves it at that. But he says it's based on ancient sources, based in antiquity, all sorts of meaning, whatever vagueness of his own language. Because Yaakov Emden still accepted Kabbalah. His Siddur is based on Kabbalah. Meaning he questions much of the authority as being a new revelation, but he accepts Kabbalah. Now there's a story that he relied on from the Shalshelet HaKabbalah that talks about the story of Isaac of Akka, who was a 13th century Kabbalist when gathering traditions. He started in Akko, he moved around the Mediterranean, and he wound up in Italy, North Africa, Spain.
Is that Isaac of
Akko? No, Isaac of Akko.
Okay.
And Isaac of Akko, and in this story told in the Shalshelet HaKabbalah in the 16th century, Isaac of Akko knocked on the widow Moshe de Leon's door. And widow de Leon says, "Go away, Gayavek. I don't need you. I don't want to answer it." He knocks again, and she says, "I have nothing for you. There are no manuscripts of the Zohar. Don't you understand? There were no ancient manuscripts. He just wrote them to make money. So go away." The Shalshelet HaKabbalah says the manuscript story broke off. We don't have the end of the story. But what we do know is that Isaac of Akko, in his writings, the Meir HaLeinayim and the Otzur Chaim, treats the Zohar as definitive. We know the actual Isaac of Akko treated it as an important work, even though this 16th century story, 300 years, talks about him being told that it's a forgery. Yaakov Emden presents de Leon as the editor. Gretz, the historian, makes it into Moshe de Leon the forger. That he got there and made it up. Gershon Sholom eventually accepted Gretz's opinion and made Moshe de Leon the author. For those who want a good summary of the issues as they were between Yaakov Emden and all the German, both the German scholarly and the religious literature of Eastern Europe, you can look at Hillel Zeitlin, Befardes Chassidut of the Kabbalah, in which he presents the arguments showing you how different the texts of Moshe de Leon are than the Zohar, and going through point by point showing that it's much more complex. Shalom hated Zeitlin's presentation, didn't want to have anything to do with it. There's another element here, is that when Shalom first came to Hebrew U in his inaugural lecture in 1929, he wanted to show that the Zohar was ancient. By 1934, he reversed his opinion and said it's Moshe de Leon. But all the material to prove its antiquity is still in that inaugural lecture collected. Currently, and we're going to deal with more because you don't have enough detail to go in, currently at every session at Hebrew U this summer at the World Congress of Jewish Studies, the phrase people now use is the Chavraya of Authors and Editors of the Zohar. That is the official phrase, and it's everyone each in their own way to try to unpack what that means. Because by this point we know there are passages, even on the editorial level, that were edited by Rav Yosef Angelet, that were edited by Rav Yosef Abba Mishushan Habira, that came from all different places, and you know, some of them you can see once you read the 13th century literature, you see other people's hands even as editors. And then dealing even in terms of the antiquity, know there are people, for example, like Ronit Meiroz, who shows that the Nikud system at points in the Zohar is the ancient Babylonian Nikud, not Tveria. So therefore, it clearly is not, meaning it was preserving ancient traditions. And there are others who are, you know, going through Cairo Geniza, showing that there are ancient pieces of it pre-Spain. So right now it's an open field for really having to go page by page to add how it got there, what was there, how, where it came from, who edited it, and the story of each. Next level of complexity. Whether there even is such a thing called the Zohar, which is also beginning to fade away. The Zohar is something created by the printers in the 16th century. Unlike the Mishneh Torah, which was a book once the Rambam wrote it, and you can ask questions on the Rambam to his son, the Zohar was never a book. The Zohar was a general corpus of Midrashic texts, which, like Tanhuma and Yalkut Shmoni, are rather open-ended and have no real end of closure. And what's in and what's out was a printer's decision in the 16th century. So much so that there could be, you know, there are straight passages from other Svarim that are in the Zohar. There are things that just come in. There was no thing, nobody in the 14th century is reading Sefer HaZohar. Meaning in the 14th century, what they are reading is they are reading Rikonati, they are reading Me'irat Einayim, they are reading Bachya Al HaTorah, they are reading books that use Zohar corpus, and it's post the printing decision of the 16th century that the Ramak and the Ari now write Perushim on the Zohar. I mean, there was Zohar corpus, and it wasn't, there was a whole literature that was out there whose parameters are yet to be, meaning, you know, God bless her, Ronit Meiroz has identified 3,500 or something fragments of things that are called from the Zohar literature in like the 14th, 15th century. I mean, amazing patience to go through that. Things that people, citations and fragments of 13, 14, pre-printing press. I mean, the point is, now is the test. Now that she gave you, you know, 3,000 manuscript numbers, you can go back and figure out what do they refer to and how did each one get there. Yes?
She just found every
citation. Well, with computers, it's actually a lot easier. You can start typing in words into Bar-Ilan data bank. And
so it's really just to make sure thousands of
documents. It's thousands of documents that are together, but it's not really thousands. I mean, there's actually, you know, clear pieces within it. That being said, there are parts that have no question that clearly are in Moshe de Leon's Hebrew, but there are other parts that are clearly not. You will not be sensitive enough to that, unlike by the end of the Hasidut course, where you can tell the difference between the Maggid of Mezrich and the Toldot Yaakov Yosef. You will not be sensitized enough by the end of this course to do that. That's seen as then doing Kriya B'Zohar, covering enough ground with the parallels of 13th century figures in which you actually get a sense of the writings. Okay, any questions on that? Yes? End of the 18th century. That's going to be part of what we're going to get to, is it's going to be somewhat much more complex on another level that I wasn't going to go into. What's ancient and what's modern is also the reverse of what you think. Meaning, originally if you were going to make something ancient, you would say the Shimon Bar Yochai stories are ancient, but the Kabbalah, I mean some of the more technical Kabbalah, is the most recent. In fact, they're finding it's much more the other way around. Some of the most esoteric, cryptic passages are the most ancient, while this very beautiful medieval romance narrative is going to be some of the later parts. And that you'll, by the end of this course, be able to tell the difference. between passages that are here is a piece of ancient esotericism talking about God and this beautiful medieval setting that it has. So even that question becomes a question that you now have to get everyone together. And there's a lot of books that the Zohar had on his shelf, which even becomes the question, and this I'll finish. The books that the Zohar had on his shelf are books that themselves are late and underwent the same editorial process of the Zohar. For example, a book that most of you don't know, a book called Chronicle of Yerachmiel, which was a reworking of Midrash and a lot of stories, antiquity, and all sorts of ancient stuff, the Zohar will have a copy of it. Or now that we have Qumran, we now have parallels between Qumran and Zohar. How did it get there? We have no idea. For example, the four archangels is in Qumran, it's in the Zohar, it's not in Midrash. How did it make that jump? We don't know. Or another thing, the Zohar and Provence have Sefer HaYovlot, if you did Book of Jubilees with Professor Bernstein. How Jubilees wound up in Provence becomes the question. Or the Zohar will quote Sefer Adam V'Chava, which only preserved in Church Slavonic, was not even preserved in Hebrew altogether. How do we have books like that and parallels in the Zohar has yet to be fully resolved. This has been only since Sholem has passed away, and in the last decade or so has there really been a sea change that people can now begin to start these questions in any serious way. So already there is an index. We'll talk about it more in a journal called Kabbalah, Volume 3, that this all the parallels in Bayit Sheni literature to things in the Zohar, but nobody's put out any great articles giving you the connections. And this is where we're going to take up next class. So in conclusion of the first class, because we're going to have to deal with it much more in future classes, know that the current state of the field is, at Hebrew University, you'll just say the authors of the Zohar corpus, the text of the Zohar. Nobody makes a one-to-one relationship with Moshe de Leon anymore. People now, one, question whether there is such a thing as a corpus of the Zohar or a single book rather than a collection of many, many different things. Two, many of the parts, once you're not looking at Svirot, but you are looking at divine names, angels, gematriot, pieces of theosophy, go back to Bayit Sheni, even if the setting is medieval, and even those parts that are clearly are medieval.